is Andy's Restaurant versus the City of Gary.
Please the court. As an initial matter, as I discussed in my brief, the City of Gary did not meet the requirements for supporting a motion for summary judgment under the federal rules. They didn't provide any factual support or evidentiary foundation for the materials they submitted. There was a lot of talk in their summary judgment brief about what the City of Gary meant when they considered these materials, etc. That is just that. That is talk. It is not evidence. And for those reasons alone, this court should reverse and remand. Now, if we look at what I think both sides agree would be the appropriate analysis, which is the Renton Alameda Books analysis. The first question, of course, is does the regulation, and here we're talking about hour restrictions and door open booth restrictions for adult entertainment establishments, books, bookstores, and entertainment cabarets, do the regulations impose a ban? And I think both sides agree that no, there is no ban per se imposed upon appellants. The next question, is it a content neutral or content based regulation?
Before you go into that, the defendant's brief states that every appellate court to review hours of operation regulations, and then there's six of those cases have upheld them as constitutional. And I was wondering if you found any cases going the other way. Is there any way to distinguish those six cases?
I think there is. After Alameda Book, the Supreme Court has suggested that the courts must do more than simply accept the rationale offered by the government. And in most of those cases, I believe, they're prior to Alameda, and there was no real consideration as to whether or not the hour restriction had an impact, had a significant or substantial impact on the bookstore. And there's one case by this court that is relevant to your inquiry that I believe was decided subsequent to Alameda, and that's the GM Enterprises case. And in that case, the town actually submitted affidavits attesting to their studies, to the cases, to police reports, and so forth, and testifying that every member of the board actually spent time reviewing these materials. They had an affidavit by the county sheriff and so forth. There's nothing like that in the present case.
Wasn't there a testimony, at least by affidavit, from police officers who discovered prostitution in some instances and other types of misconduct?
I believe there were police reports, yes, attached to the discovery materials. There was no foundation established for any of that. There was no factual record produced explaining what those were, why they were relevant to my clients in particular, or why they were relevant really to the restrictions that we're talking about here, which are our indoor restrictions. I don't believe any of those reports concerned door regulations at all, for example.
Don't we have some cases in our circuit, though, that refer to removal of doors and where they can be viewed without restriction?
Absolutely. There are cases in this circuit. Again, the cases have been primarily decided prior to Alameda Books. The courts have... Let me explain. The Alameda Books confirmed that this court is not to sit as a rubber stamp to these municipalities, to these governmental bodies who are just positing that there are these secondary effects out there and that the regulations that they are enacting are legitimate or that they're narrowly tailored or anything else. What Alameda Books says is the government has to set forth some reason, and then the burden is shifted if the the adult bookstore, adult entertainment cabaret, then comes forth with some question, questioning the validity of the studies, of the link between the ordinance and the result. Then the burden gets shifted back to the municipality. And remember, the municipality is... has the ultimate burden of proof, and they have the burden of persuasion, not only in summary judgment, but ultimately these types
What evidence did you submit with your summary judgment motion? In response to the summary judgment motion?
There were two things mainly that we submitted. When the Alameda Court talked about burden shifting, it said that the plaintiff can cast direct doubt either by demonstrating that the municipality's evidence does not support its rationale or by furnishing evidence. We did the former. We demonstrated that the municipality's evidence did not support the rationale. And
how did you use that with the booths?
I could not identify anything as I went through the thousands and thousands of pages of studies and material submitted, and I know respondent disagrees. He may have found one or two mentions of the relationship between the booth regulations and secondary effects, but there is virtually nothing in the materials that they submitted, and I went through each of those in detail, and you can review that in the brief.
Are there any other challenged ordinances that you can think of that have required sexually oriented businesses to close as early as 11 p.m.?
I don't, there was one, I believe, that respondents said was more restrictive. I don't believe it was an 11 p.m. closing. I believe it was a 12 p.m. closing.
Yeah, that's Schultz versus that's City of Cumberland. That's a 12 o'clock closing.
That's a 12 o'clock closing. And then they were also not permitted to open on Sunday, and there's no Sunday closing provision here. So I would submit it is substantially more burdensome on my clients because of that. In addition to attacking the evidence, which if this court really looks at the studies, really looks at the information, the supposed affidavits, police reports, etc., it will conclude that it does not support these types of regulations, hours or doors. Now, Your Honor asked about other door regulations. For instance, matinee, of course, is one of them where the court did uphold the door regulation. I would say a few things about that. First of all, here we've provided an affidavit showing the impact, and that's something that we did submit on summary judgment, an affidavit showing the impact, the substantial, significant impact on speech of the door and of the hour restriction. And certainly that wasn't produced in the Matney case. And I would refer this court to Playboy Enterprises. When there is significant curtailment of speech, there is a higher standard that the court must use. Now, there's something else that I don't recall whether or not the court addressed in Matney and some of the Enberg and some of the other Doar cases, but that is, in this case, the ordinance is worded so that the entire interior of the booth has to be visible from the manager's station. And so what that effectively does, it makes it so that anybody in the store, the manager, and everyone and anyone else can also view the materials.
How does that interfere with the communication of the erotic messages?
Well, for one, it chills the person actually viewing the materials. It chills them from choosing the type of expression that they might want to choose to view. The other thing is you look at Erznoznik, and there the court recognized that allowing people to view a screening from the street also chilled the proprietor, because everyone, again, was able to watch the movie to the detriment of the business. Same type of thing here. There are other ways to configure these booths, and not saying that...
I'm not quite sure. How does that interfere with somebody's ability to watch a video if the people can see them?
I believe this court has rejected this, but I would still contend that there are a variety of types of expression. When we're talking here, we're talking about sexually explicit, generally expression, but there are subcategories, different types of expression, and the fact that I cannot go into a booth and I may be chilled from viewing a particular type of sexually explicit expression because I don't want my neighbor to see what I'm watching or viewing. It's similar to in the library. You don't want someone looking over your shoulder seeing what you're reading. In the voting booth, you have some expectation of privacy, and I know this court has rejected that, but I would submit that that is a legitimate concern here, as well as there's not as Nasnik concern. Now, I think that another point that needs to be discussed is really the purpose behind distinguishing between, you know, primary and secondary effects. The court must decide this is a time, place, manner regulation, but what is the primary purpose of the ordinance? What effect does it have on speech? Secondary effects are those unrelated to the impact of the speech. Primary effects are effects directly caused by the speech itself. And here, the city has essentially admitted that its ordinance is based on these primary effects. They're saying because of the nature of the expression, because of the very nature, it downgrades the quality of life, contributes to urban blight, causes an increase in crime, decrease in property values, adversely affects the character, and they claim that they're entitled to preserve and protect the morals of the community. And they're saying and admitting that these things are directly related to the type of speech, the nature of the speech. That suggests, it's not dispositive, that suggests, and reading this in the light most favorable to the non-movement and drawing all inferences in favor of the non-movement, that suggests that their reason is not to curtail, quote, secondary effects, but to curtail primary effects. And in both Renton and Alameda, we were dealing with an ordinance, a zoning ordinance, that dealt with locational restrictions. In other words, two adult businesses could not be located within 1,000 feet of each other. And what I think it was Justice Kennedy was careful to note in Alameda is that if the effect of that ordinance, of the locational restriction, was to cause the business to close, and this sort of gets into the alternative adequate avenues argument, but if it is to cause that business to close, then it would be impermissible. Instead, the presumption is that that business would move elsewhere, so speech would not be curtailed. Here, particularly with the hour regulation, the regulation itself, by its very definition that it's regulating the hours, curtails the speech.
And wouldn't we find in Schultz that was permissible?
In Schultz, I believe there was evidence produced that that supported that. And I believe Schultz was also prior, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but prior to Alameda, which set forth this burden shifting that and identified the fact that you cannot rely simply on what the municipality is positing. And I see my time is up. If there are no further questions.
Okay, fine. That's your rebuttal time, so you have time.
Please, the court. My name is Scott Berchtold, and I represent the appellee, the City of Gary. We ask this court to affirm the judgment below for the reasons set forth in our brief. Today, I want to address the points that Ms. Baumann raised and the order in which she raised them, but start out with a preliminary note to note that, as the district court properly observed, this is a case that had 4 years of opportunity for plaintiffs to take a deposition, hire an expert, put on evidence. At the conclusion of that 4 years, their only summary judgment arguments were essentially legal arguments about relevance of the city's extensive legislative record and a two-page affidavit that attested to economic harm, which this court's precedents and the Supreme Court's precedents foreclose as an irrelevant inquiry under the First Amendment.
What are left is the issues regarding this ordinance, the booths.
That's right.
Hours of operation.
Correct. They raised a preemption issue on the liquor law that they basically admitted was waived at summary judgment, and they have a prompt judicial review argument that ignores this court's en banc decision in Graff and, most importantly, the Supreme Court's recent decision in the City of Littleton. So I don't think there's much left on either of those points, especially given the fact that from the beginning, from the very first day of application through the conclusion of judicial review, this ordinance is structured to allow continuous operation of a business, even during judicial review, even if they fail in the administrative review because they don't qualify under the ordinance. So there's massive procedural protections in this ordinance, and I don't think they have much of an argument on appeal here. They start out.
Yeah, could I just start you out with something else?
Yeah, sure.
Things? Because I don't understand why this isn't on its face a content-based regulation. In other words, the ordinance does not say, for example, that all bookstores have to close at 11 p.m., but only those that sell material with adult content. And I understand that this ordinance also applies to some businesses that, you know, are not engaged in the sale protected of expressive material at all. But this doesn't mean that the regulation is not content-based as applied to businesses that do sell expressive material. In other words, what could be more content-based than an ordinance that applies only to businesses that deal with sexual content?
Your Honor, that was a question that was first dealt with in Young versus American Mini Theaters, in which the court concluded that the content, the interest behind the ordinance, preventing prostitution, crime, unsanitary sexual activity in the peep show booths, for example, all of those interests are unrelated to the suppression of speech. So they look at the interest and its justification and note that that's content neutral. In Renton, the court followed Virginia Pharmacy Council in coming to that conclusion, and that was affirmed by this court in numerous decisions leading up until Alameda Books. And then in Alameda Books, Justice Kennedy says, well, this content-neutral, content-based distinction is somewhat of a fiction, but on its face, the prima facie purpose to regulate the externalities or the negative secondary effects of adult businesses is a content-neutral purpose, and therefore intermediate scrutiny applies. The second thing that is relevant to that question is that the court has consistently required that these ordinances be narrowly tailored to only regulate those types of businesses that are associated with the negative secondary effects, and those are the adult bookstores, the strip clubs, and the like. And so the city certainly can't be charged with being content-based because they're following closely the Supreme Court's narrow tailoring analysis.
Well, from your point of view, how restrictive would the regulation of hours have to be before that regulation unconstitutionally limited free expression? In other words, suppose all adult businesses had to close by 5 p.m. What I'm wondering about was, what was the basis for choosing 11 p.m. as the closing time?
Well, Your Honor, there were, as opposing counsel noted, this ordinance is less restrictive because it allows almost 400 hours more a year in operation than the previous hours of operation standard upheld by this court in Schultz. There are more restrictive regulations, such as a 10 p.m. closing time and a total closure on Sundays, that was upheld by the Third Circuit in the Mitchell case, and then the Sixth Circuit has a couple of cases. So those are all more restrictive. The city did not choose one as restrictive to that, but they did have secondary effects occurring during the overnight hours. They had done crime maps. They had not only looked at this broad panoply of studies, but they had also looked at the crime maps that showed secondary effects during the overnight hours, and noting that during the darkness, policing is inherently more difficult and more dangerous. They chose those hours, even if the higher patronage might be between 4 and 11 and therefore have a more salutary effect. You have to balance the concern with allowing ample alternative avenues of communication.
Well, I would surmise that, SOBs do more business late at night than they do on Sundays, and that's what you have in Schultz, of course.
Well, I think, Your Honor, that surmising may bear out. I think the weekend overall is the time in which these are most frequently because people are not at work. And many courts, I think out of those six appellate cases cited by the Ninth Circuit in the post-Alameda Books decision, Center for Fair Public Policy, I think four or five of those had Sunday closing hours, including the law in Center for Fair Public Policy. However, this law allows for more expression to take place by allowing more hours and therefore balances that interest.
Do you know with any other time regulations that have required adult-oriented businesses to close as early as this one?
Yes, the Tenth Circuit's decision in Mitchell versus Adult Entertainment Commissions. The site is 10 F3rd 123.
And what time was that?
That was a 10 p.m. closing, a 10 a.m. opening, and then a total closure on Sunday. Likewise, there's two cases from the Sixth Circuit. The first one is, they're both called Richland Bookmart versus Nichols. And those both deal with something similar to the Schultz case in this circuit, where you have a midnight closure time, but all the closure on Sundays. And so those are both, all three of those cases are more restrictive. This one allows approximately 400 hours more a year than what the court upheld in Schultz. And there were, and contrary to opposing counsel's argument, there were evidence in the materials in the legislative record that were relevant to the hours of operation restriction, including the Garden Grove study, the Adams County study dealt with. And that's in our record in the summary judgment appendix, which is appellant's app 3, I think. It's number 20 in that list of studies. Adams County, Colorado, only allowed nude dancing between 4 and midnight. So there was only an 8-hour window in which that activity was allowed. So it was much more restrictive even than the federal appellate courts have upheld. And I believe the Adams County case was 7250 Court versus Adams County in the Colorado Supreme Court, if I'm not mistaken on that.
So can we go into the search aspect of the ordinance?
Certainly, Your Honor.
Because your brief stated that only visual inspection of the premises is contemplated. But what language in the ordinance would stop authorities from performing the kind of searches that were condemned in low G sales and during video? Because the ordinance says a search can only be made of public areas during normal business hours, but nothing says you can only do what a normal business patron can do.
Well, Your Honor, two things. Of course, our first argument on appeal is that this was waived because they did not argue any evidence that would establish a Fourth Amendment violation. And sort of a corollary to that is because this is a facial challenge, this court's decision in Doe v. Heck says that the Solano test has to be met. In other words, they have to prove it's not like Logi sales and drone video where you had specific facts and a warrantless search that was taking place. This is a facial challenge to a regulatory scheme that under Doe v. Heck has to satisfy Solano test and therefore be unconstitutional in all of its applications. But related to your question is the ordinance says that only compliance with this particular chapter is allowed for visual inspection. So they'll go in, they'll look at the stage, they can look at the configuration of the booths, they can only go, like you said, to the areas of the premises where patrons are allowed and only during business hours.
Well, okay, could the police, for instance, bring in a team of crime scene investigators and swab the public places for body fluid and then submit those swabs to DNA testing to run against criminal data banks? What in the ordinance would prohibit that? Can they do that?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. Because the ordinance doesn't have any specific prohibition on sexual fluids in the booths. It has a prohibition on the configuration of the booths that is designed to prevent that illicit sexual behavior. So they can come in and see how the booths are configured, but nothing in the ordinance gives the authority to do that type of investigation with the police or the teams of investigators or whatever. To the extent that a normal patron could walk in off the street and go into the booths, I suppose they could do that, but there's nothing in the ordinance that authorizes. The regulatory scheme has a configuration requirement, and this follows that requirement.
Are you saying that the normal business patron could go around swabbing? Is that what you're saying?
Well, the problem is, because the way the booths are configured, the management wouldn't know. I think that when the booths are configured according to the terms of the ordinance, then no, because nobody would be able to do that. I mean, I don't think someone could take something off the premises under the terms of this ordinance. I think that would be that might rise to the level of a seizure in the sense that it has a meaningful interference with a possessory interest. If this court could conclude that such a swabbing was a meaningful interference with a possessory interest, but what the district court did in this facial challenge is he looked at the language of the ordinance and he looked at the fact that Logi sales wasn't cited to him, Durham video was not cited to him, all those cases were cited for the first time in appellant's brief on appeal, and he said because they don't meet the first issue of a hurdle, and that is a reasonable expectation of privacy, and that's an interest that society is ready to regulate or to recognize as reasonable. Because that hasn't been infringed, Fourth Amendment analysis of a search or seizure doesn't kick in. And he didn't note this, but I note this in our reply brief, that the Maryland versus Macon case distinguished Logi sales and distinguished in none of these other cases that might involve some type of First Amendment business like a bookstore, but realized that that doesn't necessarily trigger a Fourth Amendment claim. I think that the possessory interest that was interfered with, if any, by the purchase of the obscene magazine in Maryland is greater than what anything contemplated in the facial portions of the ordinance.
Can authorities ask patrons to voluntarily disclose?
No. No. Nothing in this ordinance has anything to do with disclosure of names by patrons. Absolutely not.
And they take photos and videos of patrons?
No, Your Honor, I think that would be the Durham video type of case where there's a signpost that said no taking pictures and people come in and take pictures. That would obviously be violation of an interest that's against the rules. And besides, it has nothing to do with what's in the ordinance, because there's nothing in the ordinance explicitly that regulates the conduct of patrons except a nudity prohibition that applies to everybody.
Except if an ordinance if an inspection ordinance is viewed as, too open-ended, then...
Your Honor, perhaps. Now, there were a couple of cases that we distinguished in our brief. We cited the FWPBS case, which allowed inspections according to the law, and there's some other cases that don't limit it to public areas, and that's part of the problem that you have in some of these other cases. But this is only limited to public areas and only those portions of the premises that are during business hours. So it's only where a patron can go. And it's not to take something from the business. It's only to check for the visual compliance with the ordinance terms, which are objective and straightforward.
I've not read Mitchell or either of the Richland cases, so you tell me, is there anything in those cases that differentiates our case?
The only difference, I think, Your Honor, would be that in both cases, compared to both cases, our legislative record is much more substantial. I think that would be the main distinction. And I also would note that there's another case, the Lady J. Lingerie case, that dealt with the closing hours. It's from the 11th Circuit, and they said, the goal is not to, go hour by hour, and can you prove secondary effects at 9:15 in the morning rather than 9:30. Under the narrow tailoring analysis from this court's decision in Matney and other cases, it's whether the substantial government interest would be achieved less effectively absent the regulation, and the reasonable alternative avenues question is answered with the question of whether there's a reasonable opportunity to disseminate the speech at issue. And the courts have looked at that in the aggregate. This has approximately 400 hours more a year that's allowed than the previous decision from this court in Schultz, and therefore we think it's constitutional. If I may, Judge Rovner, return, I don't want to miss my opposing counsel's points about the content neutrality issue. Certainly, these are statements read completely out of context. There's nothing in the ordinance that says nature of expression. It doesn't say that at all. They actually interject that into the ordinance to substantiate their argument on appeal. It talks about these businesses due to their nature. It's not talking about regulating the content of speech. It applies, as you noted, to expressive and non-expressive businesses alike. And because sexually oriented businesses are of a kind that attracts crime, prostitutes, and patrons susceptible to vice overtures, which the legislative record thoroughly demonstrates, doesn't mean that regulating to prevent those types of activities is a content-based motivation. Nor is the reference to morals further than the general health, safety, morals, welfare language in one preamble portion of the ordinance doesn't deny the explicit purpose stated in the ordinance that the district court noted to decrease secondary effects. While prostitution, sexual liaisons of casual nature, and drugs may be a general detriment to community morals in the general sense, regulating to prevent those doesn't smack of censorship, and it doesn't have anything to do with regulating the content. Moreover, I just looked back at the Renton case in the dissent at page 59, 475 U.S. at 59, in note 3 of the dissent. There's a finding in the Renton ordinance that talks about morals and everything, and obviously the majority rejected that argument about the content-based claim. Now, opposing Ms. Baumann claims that they attacked our studies. They did no such thing. They presented this one affidavit against 1,600 pages of a thorough legislative record from around the country, as well as affidavits, not just police reports, and there were a number of those in the pre-enactment legislative record, but also specific affidavits about the unhealthy conditions in booths in the city of Gary. Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 56, of course, says that the court should look at the answers to the interrogatories, which are at Record 104, Exhibit A, pages 6 through 20 lay out the extensive legislative record, and pages 20 through 24 talk about the post-enactment record that documented ongoing secondary effects, as well as the affidavits and then the affidavit of counsel in Record Entry 112, that's Exhibit A, that talks about the process that the city went through in looking at the legislative record. So there are affidavits in the record that establish this extensive process, as well as what's laid out right in the text of the ordinance that the the city is relying on. Now, what they say is that it's not reasonably believed to be relevant because these are zoning studies. But in the Supreme Court's decision in Erie, the court said the character of the adult entertainment at Candyland in that case was of the same essential character as that talked about in Young and Renton, which were zoning cases. So they definitely had cross-application of negative secondary effects information within the categories of regulations from zoning to nude dancing and the like. She claims that the studies are old, but this court's decision in GM Enterprises noted that in Alameda Books, the Supreme Court countenanced reliance on a study that was 25 years old.
Wait, did you say Schultz?
No, GM Enterprises.
Oh, okay.
This court talked about in Alameda Books, you have a 25-year-old study. The Supreme Court says that's relevant. It's on point. And then similarly, the argument was not an evidentiary challenge like you see in many of these adult entertainment cases post-Alameda Books, in which have been rejected in the GM Enterprises case and other. But rather, this is just legal claims, relevance claims. And under the broad, reasonably believed to be relevant standard, the evidence that the city relied on, as well as the specific cases from this court upholding booth regulations in Berg, Matney, and Pleasureland, as well as hours regulation in Dima and Schultz, both established the negative secondary effects basis and the narrow tailing of these regulations. Now, as Judge Keenan noted, there's actually more speech going on and more speech being received and sent under the open booth regulations because opposing counsel claimed, well, then everybody will be able to get to see these movies. Well, that only increases the net amount of speech. It doesn't cause a decrease. And therefore, I think this court's decision in Matney on the booths and in Schultz and the other cases thoroughly support our theories and the district court's judgment, which the district court particularly found that nothing in all the legislative record or the stated explicit purpose of the ordinance supports the theory that this is content-based. What opposing counsel has done is mixed the second and third prongs of the Renton inquiry by saying, well, the trial court gave blind deference to the content, the findings of the ordinance and the purpose statements. No, the court only looked at those to look at the objective factors of intent, like the Jolmer case that this court said he ought to do. You look at the findings and the purpose statement and the studies of which there were. And then he went through the paces and he looked at the cases and the studies and how they supported these negative secondary effects rationale. The only thing he offered was an affidavit. The district court answered this affidavit because at first they only claimed an economic impact, and in their post-judgment motion for emergency relief, for the first time, they claimed that it impacts the nature and the quantity of the speech. The court found that these arguments were foreclosed under the relevant law, and he also found that the affidavit doesn't mention anything at all about the number of patrons using the establishment, nor does it do any type of comparison of before the establishment versus after this temporary compliance. There are other problems with the affidavit, but those two on a legal level foreclose its reliance on it. Finally, my opposing counsel cites the Playboy case, but the district court again answered this correctly. The Playboy case specifically distinguishes the Renton line of cases and says that secondary effects justifications for time, place, and manner statutes or regulations are not the same as content-based restrictions like those addressed in the Playboy case or Erznozdik, of course, which was decided 1 year before the Supreme Court decided the Renton case, which is the seminal decision to be followed here. In conclusion, Your Honor, this case involves an extensive legislative record, a narrowly tailored ordinance, and a district court decision that faithfully follows this court's and the Supreme Court's precedents. For these reasons, we ask this court to affirm the judgment below.
Thank you, Mr. Brown.
Thank you.
You have 4 minutes, Ms. Bowman.
Counsel claims that I somehow made up this language about the nature of the very I will let you be the judge of that, review the ordinance, also review the request to admit in which that they admitted that because of the very nature of the businesses, of sexually oriented businesses, they had the right to accommodate these enactments. Those are primary effects, not secondary effects. That's the significance of that. Secondary effects warrant the intermediate scrutiny. Primary effects would be a content-based regulation. They are primary effects that they're attempting to regulate here. I don't have the Mitchell case with me at present, so I cannot comment on that. I believe Mitchell and some of those other cases are older cases, and the court can review those and determine was there any legitimate basis for the hour regulations in those cases. I submit there is not. I submit that you will find that Mitchell is like many of the other cases supporting regulations. They just repeat one after the other the same cases, the same quote-unquote studies, but no one has really looked at the evidence, looked to see whether there, in fact, is a substantial connection between the regulation and what the municipalities are attempting to achieve. And that is the burden of the municipality. Ultimately, they must meet the time, place, manner test, and they must meet each element of that. And here, even if we assume that they were regulating secondary effects, there is no indication whatsoever from this record that the hour and door regulations are narrowly tailored to achieve whatever purpose, whatever governmental interest, even assuming that there are substantial interests in promoting safety, and there are, they have not come forth with a single iota of evidence to suggest that their ordinance should be upheld for that purpose. The Fourth Amendment issue was addressed by the court below and therefore is not waived, and Your Honor is absolutely correct in noting there is absolutely no limitation upon the breadth of the search. And counsel can stand here and explain things and give the court his view of how things should be or how he believes the city of Gary would act, which is in fact exactly what he did in his summary judgment motion, not evidence, simply argument, but that's not sufficient. The ordinance itself is facially.
I recall reading some affidavits by police officers regarding prostitution and other submitted as part of the summary judgment, don't I? Wasn't there?
If I recall, and I did not go through the record in preparing because it's voluminous, there were affidavits from 2003 from some of the adult entertainment cabarets, none of whom are my clients. And again, there might be some prostitution. There may have been some prostitution problems at some point. How do these regulations, the hour and door restrictions, how do they relate to the problem of prostitution, which, as far as the city of Gary, you know, admits, can exist throughout the city and not particularly in relation to these adult uses? There's no showing of connection, and for that reason, this court must reverse the decision. Thank you.
Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.